Part 2. Management is a team game. Chapter 3. Managerial leverage. What is a manager's output? I asked a group of middle managers just that question. I got these responses. Judgments and opinions. Direction. Allocation of resources. Mistakes detected. Personnel trained and subordinates developed, courses taught, products planned, commitments negotiated. Do these things really constitute the output of a manager? I don't think so. They are instead activities or descriptions of what managers do as they try to create a final result or output. What then is a manager's output? At Intel, if she is in charge of a wafer fabrication plant, her output consists of completed, high-quality, fully processed silicon wafers. If he supervises a design group, his output consists of completed designs that work correctly and are ready to go into manufacturing. If a manager is the principal of a high school, her output will be trained and educated students who have either completed their schooling or are ready to move on to the next year of their studies. If a manager is a surgeon, his output is a fully recovered, healed patient. We can sum matters up with the proposition that a manager's output equals the output of his organization plus the output of the neighboring organizations under his influence. Why? Because business and education and even surgery represent work done by teams. A manager can do his own job, his individual work, and do it well, but that does not constitute his output. If the manager has a group of people reporting to him, or a circle of people influenced by him, the manager's output must be measured by the output created by his subordinates and associates. If the manager is a knowledge specialist, a know-how manager, his potential for influencing neighboring organizations is enormous. The internal consultant who supplies needed insight to a group struggling with a problem will affect the work and the output of the entire group. Similarly, if a lawyer acquires a regulatory permit for a drug company, he will release the flow of the result of many years of research at that company to the public. Or a marketing analyst who reviews mountains of product, market, and competitive information, analyzes market research, and makes fact-finding visits can directly affect the output of many neighboring organizations. His interpretations of the data and his recommendations will perhaps guide the activities for the whole company. Thus, the definition of manager should be broadened. Individual contributors who gather and disseminate know-how and information should also be seen as middle managers because they exert great power within the organization. But the key definition here is that the output of a manager is a result achieved by a group either under her supervision or under her influence. While the manager's own work is clearly very important, that in itself does not create output. Her organization does. By analogy, a coach or a quarterback alone does not score touchdowns and win games. Entire teams with their participation and guidance and direction do. League standings are kept by team, not by individual. Business, and this means not just the business of commerce, but the business of education, the business of government, the business of medicine, is a team activity. And always, it takes a team to win. It is important to understand that a manager will find himself engaging in an array of activities in order to affect output. As the middle managers I queried said, a manager must form opinions and make judgments. He must provide direction. He must allocate resources. He must detect mistakes, and so on. All these are necessary to achieve output. But output and activity are by no means the same thing. Consider my own managerial role. As president of a company, I can affect output through my direct subordinates, group general managers, and others like them, by performing supervisory activities. I can also influence groups not under my direct supervision by making observations and suggestions to those who manage them. Both types of activity will, I hope, contribute to my output as a manager by contributing to the output of the company as a whole. I was once asked by a middle manager at Intel how I could teach in-plant courses, visit manufacturing plants, concern myself with the problems of people several levels removed from me in the organization, and still have time to do my job. I asked him what he thought my job was. He thought for a moment and then answered his own question. I guess those things are your job too, aren't they? They are absolutely my job. Not my entire job, but part of it, because they help add to the output of Intel. Let me give another example. Cindy, an engineer at Intel, supervises an engineering group in a wafer fabrication plant. She also spends some of her time as a member of an advisory body that establishes standard procedures by which all the plants throughout the company perform a certain technical process. In both roles, Cindy contributes to the output of the wafer fabrication plants. As a supervising engineer, she performs activities that increase the output of the plant in which she works. As a member of the advisory body, she provides specialized knowledge that will influence and increase the output of neighboring organizations, all the other Intel wafer fabrication plants. Let's refer again to our black box. If the machinery within an organization can be compared to a series of gears, we can visualize how a middle manager affects output. In times of crisis, he provides power to the organization. When things aren't working as smoothly as they should, he applies a bit of oil. And of course, he provides intelligence to the machine to direct its purpose. Daddy, what do you really do? Most of us have had to struggle to answer that question. What we actually do is difficult to pin down and sum up. Much of it often seems so inconsequential that our position in the business hardly seems justified. Part of the problem here stems from the distinction between our activities, which is what we actually do, and our output, which is what we achieve. The latter seems important, significant, and worthwhile. The former often seems trivial, insignificant, and messy. But a surgeon whose output is a cured patient spends his time scrubbing and cutting and suturing, and this hardly sounds very respectable either. To find out what we managers really do, let's take a look at one of my busier days. Here, I describe the activity in which I was engaged, explain it a bit, and categorize it into types we shall examine in the balance of the chapter. A day from my life. 8 o'clock to 8:30. Met with the manager who had submitted his resignation to leave for another company. I listened to his reasons, information gathering, felt he could be turned around and saved for Intel, encouraged him to talk to certain other managers about a career change, nudge, and decided to pursue this matter with them myself, decision-making. Followed by incoming telephone call from a competitor. Call was ostensibly about a meeting of an industry-wide society, but in reality, he was feeling out how I saw his business conditions. I did the same. Information gathering. Followed by 8:30 to 9 o'clock. Read mail from the previous afternoon. I scribbled messages on about half of it, some of which were expressions of encouragement or disapproval, others exhortations to take certain types of action, nudges. One was the denial of a request to proceed with a particular small project, decision-making. Of course, information gathering took place in all of these cases too. Followed by 9 o'clock to 12 o'clock, executive staff meeting, a regular weekly meeting of the company's senior management. Subjects covered at this particular one: review of the prior month's incoming order and shipment rates, information gathering, discussion to set priorities for the upcoming annual planning process, decision-making, review of the status of a major marketing program, scheduled subject. This came about through a prior decision that this program was faltering and required review. We found it was doing a little bit better than before, information gathering, but the presentation still elicited a lot of comments and suggestions, nudges, from various members of the audience. Followed by review of a program to reduce the manufacturing cycle time of a particular product line, scheduled subject. The presentation indicated that the program was in good shape. It represented only information gathering. No further action was stimulated. Followed by 12 o'clock to 1 o'clock, lunch in the company cafeteria. I happened to sit with members of our training organization who complained about the difficulty they had in getting me and other senior managers to participate in training at our foreign locations, information gathering. This was news to me. I made a note to follow up with my own schedule, as well as with my staff, and to nudge them into doing a better job supporting the foreign training program. Followed by 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock, meeting regarding a specific product quality problem. The bulk of the meeting involved getting sufficient information on the status of the product and the corrective action that had been implemented, information gathering. The meeting ended in a decision made by the division manager, with my concurrence, to resume shipment of the product. Followed by 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock, lecture at our employee orientation program. This is a program in which senior management gives all professional employees a presentation describing the objectives, history, management, systems, etc., of the company and its major groups. I am the first lecturer in the series. This clearly represented information giving, and I was a role model not only in communicating the importance we place on training, but also by my handling of questions and comments in representing, in living form, some of the values of the company. The nature of the questions, at the same time, gave me a feeling for the concerns and understanding level of a large number of employees to whom I would not otherwise have access. So this also represented information gathering, characteristic of the visit type in its efficiency. Followed by 4 o'clock to 4:45, in the office, returning phone calls. I disapproved granting a compensation increase to a particular employee, which I thought was way outside of the norm, clearly a decision. I decided to conduct a meeting with a group of people to decide what organization would move to a new site we were opening in another state. This was a decision to hold a decision-making meeting. Followed by 4:45 to 5 o'clock, met with my assistant. Discussed a variety of requests for my time for a number of meetings in the upcoming week. Suggested alternatives where I decided not to attend. Followed by 5 o'clock to 6:15. Read the day's mail, including progress reports. As with the morning's mail reading, this was information gathering, interspersed with nudging and decision-making through my annotations and messages scribbled on much of it. When you look at what happened, you won't see any obvious patterns. I dealt with things in seemingly random fashion. My wife's reaction to my day was that it looked very much like one of her own. She was right in noting a similarity. My day always ends when I'm tired and ready to go home, not when I'm done. I am never done. Like a housewife's, a manager's work is never done. There is always more to be done, more that should be done, always more than can be done. A manager must keep many balls in the air at the same time and shift his energy and attention to activities that will most increase the output of his organization. In other words, he should move to the point where his leverage will be the greatest. As you can see, much of my day is spent acquiring information. And as you can also see, I use many ways to get it. I read standard reports and memos, but also get information ad hoc. I talk to people inside and outside the company, managers at other firms or financial analysts or members of the press. Customer complaints, both external and internal, are also a very important source of information. For example, the Intel Training Organization, which I serve as an instructor, is an internal customer of mine. To cut myself off from the casual complaints of people in that group would be a mistake, because I would miss getting an evaluation of my performance as an internal supplier. People also tell us things because they want us to do something for them. To advance their case, they will sometimes shower us with useful information. This is something we should remember, apart from whether we do as they ask. I have to confess that the information most useful to me, and I suspect most useful to all managers, comes from quick, often casual, verbal exchanges. This usually reaches a manager much faster than anything written down. And usually, the more timely the information, the more valuable it is. So why are written reports necessary at all? They obviously can't provide timely information. What they do is constitute an archive of data, help to validate ad hoc inputs, and catch, in safety net fashion, anything you may have missed. But reports also have another totally different function. As they are formulated and written, the author is forced to be more precise than he might be verbally. Hence, their value stems from the discipline and the thinking the writer is forced to impose upon himself as he identifies and deals with trouble spots in his presentation. Reports are more a medium of self-discipline than a way to communicate information. Writing the report is important. Reading it often is not. There are many parallels to this. As we will see later, the preparation of an annual plan is in itself the end, not the resulting bound volume. Similarly, our capital authorization process itself is important, not the authorization itself. To prepare and justify a capital spending request, people go through a lot of soul-searching analysis and juggling, and it is this mental exercise that is valuable. The formal authorization is useful only because it enforces the discipline of the process. To improve and maintain your capacity to get information, you have to understand the way it comes to you. There is a hierarchy involved. Verbal sources are the most valuable. But what they provide is also sketchy, incomplete, and sometimes inaccurate, like a newspaper headline that can give you only the general idea of a story. A headline can't give any of the details and might even give you a distorted idea of what the real story is. So you then read the newspaper article itself to find out who, what, where, why, and how. After this, you should have some reiteration and perspective, which can be compared to reading a news magazine or even a book. Each level in your information hierarchy is important, and you can rely on none alone. Though the most thorough information might come from the news magazine, you do not, of course, want to wait a full week after an event to find out about it. Your information sources should complement one another and also be redundant, because that gives you a way to verify what you've learned. There is an especially efficient way to get information, much neglected by most managers. That is, to visit a particular place in the company and observe what's going on there. Why should you do this? Think of what happens when somebody comes to see a manager in his office. A certain stop and start dynamic occurs when the visitor sits down, something socially dictated. While a 2-minute kernel of information is exchanged, the meeting often takes a half hour. But if a manager walks through an area and sees a person with whom he has a 2-minute concern, he can simply stop, cover it, and be on his way. Ditto for the subordinate when he initiates conversation. Accordingly, such visits are an extremely effective and efficient way to transact managerial business. Then why are they underutilized? Because of the awkwardness that managers feel about walking through an area without a specific task in mind. At Intel, we combat this problem by using programmed visits meant to accomplish formal tasks, but which also set the stage for ad hoc mini-transactions. For example, we ask our managers to participate in Mr. Clean inspections, in which they go to a part of the company that they normally wouldn't visit. The managers examine the housekeeping, the arrangement of things, the labs, and the safety equipment, and in doing so, spend an hour or so browsing around and getting acquainted with things firsthand. As can be seen from my schedule, a manager not only gathers information, but is also a source of it. He must convey his knowledge to members of his own organization and to other groups he influences. Beyond relaying facts, a manager must also communicate his objectives, priorities, and preferences as they bear on the way certain tasks are approached. This is extremely important because only if the manager imparts these will his subordinates know how to make decisions themselves that will be acceptable to the manager, their supervisor. Thus, transmitting objectives and preferred approaches constitutes a key to successful delegation. As we will see later, a shared corporate culture becomes indispensable to a business. Someone adhering to the values of a corporate culture, an intelligent corporate citizen, will behave in consistent fashion under similar conditions, which means that managers don't have to suffer the inefficiencies engendered by formal rules, procedures, and regulations that are sometimes used to get the same result. The third major kind of managerial activity, of course, is decision-making. To be sure, once in a while, we managers, in fact, make a decision. But for every time that happens, we participate in the making of many, many others, and we do that in a variety of ways. We provide factual inputs or just offer opinions. We debate the pros and cons of alternatives and thereby force a better decision to emerge. We review decisions made or about to be made by others, encourage or discourage them, ratify or veto them. Just how decisions should be made, we'll talk about later. Meanwhile, let's say that decisions can be separated into two kinds. The forward-looking sort are made, for example, in the capital authorization process. Here, we allocate the financial resources of the company among various future undertakings. The second type is made as we respond to a developing problem or crisis, which can either be technical, a quality control problem, for example, or involve people, talking somebody out of quitting. It's obvious that your decision-making depends finally on how well you comprehend the facts and issues facing your business. This is why information gathering is so important in a manager's life. Other activities, conveying information, making decisions, and being a role model for your subordinates, are all governed by the base of information that you, the manager, have about the tasks, the issues, the needs, and the problems facing your organization. In short, information gathering is the basis of all other managerial work, which is why I choose to spend so much of my day doing it. You often do things at the office designed to influence events slightly, maybe making a phone call to an associate suggesting that a decision be made in a certain way, or sending a note or a memo that shows how you see a particular situation, or making a comment during an oral presentation. In such instances, you may be advocating a preferred course of action, but you are not issuing an instruction or a command. Yet you're doing something stronger than merely conveying information. Let's call it nudging, because through it, you nudge an individual or a meeting in the direction you would like. This is an immensely important managerial activity in which we engage all the time, and it should be carefully distinguished from decision-making that results in firm, clear directives. In reality, for every unambiguous decision we make, we probably nudge things a dozen times. Finally, something more subtle pervades the day of all managers. While we move about, doing what we regard as our jobs, we are role models for people in our organization, our subordinates, our peers, and even our supervisors. Much has been said and written about a manager's need to be a leader. The fact is, no single managerial activity can be said to constitute leadership, and nothing leads as well as example. By this, I mean something straightforward. Values and behavioral norms are simply not transmitted easily by talk or memo, but are conveyed very effectively by doing and doing visibly. All managers need to act so that they can be seen exerting influence, but they should do so in their own way. Some of us feel comfortable dealing with large groups and talking about our feelings and values openly in that fashion. Others prefer working one-on-one with people in a quieter, more intellectual environment. These and other styles of leadership will work, but only if we recognize and consciously stress the need for us to be role models for people in our organization. Don't think for a moment that the way I've described leadership applies only to large operations. An insurance agent in a small office who continually talks with personal friends on the phone imparts a set of values about permissible conduct to everyone working for him. A lawyer who returns to his office after lunch a little drunk does the same. On the other hand, a supervisor in a company, large or small, who takes his work seriously exemplifies to his associates the most important managerial value of all. A great deal of a manager's work has to do with allocating resources, manpower, money, and capital. But the single most important resource that we allocate from one day to the next is our own time. In principle, more money, more manpower, or more capital can always be made available. But our own time is the one absolutely finite resource we each have. Its allocation and use, therefore, deserve considerable attention. How you handle your own time is, in my view, the single most important aspect of being a role model and leader. As you can see, in a typical day of mine, one can count some 25 separate activities in which I participated, mostly information gathering and giving, but also decision-making and nudging. You can also see that some 2/3 of my time was spent in a meeting of one kind or another. Before you are horrified by how much time I spend in meetings, answer a question. Which of the activities, information gathering, information giving, decision-making, nudging, and being a role model, could I have performed outside a meeting? The answer is practically none. Meetings provide an occasion for managerial activities. Getting together with others is not, of course, an activity, it is a medium. You as a manager can do your work in a meeting, in a memo, or through a loudspeaker, for that matter. But you must choose the most effective medium for what you want to accomplish. And that is the one that gives you the greatest leverage. More about meetings later. Leverage of managerial activity. We've established that the output of a manager is the output of the various organizations under his control and his influence. What can a manager do to increase his output? To find out, let's look at the concept of leverage. Leverage is the measure of the output generated by any given managerial activity. Accordingly, managerial output can be linked to managerial activity by the equation managerial output equals output of organization. That is, L1 times A1 plus L2 times A2 plus. This equation says that for every activity a manager performs, A1, A2, and so on, the output of the organization should increase by some degree. The extent to which that output is thereby increased is determined by the leverage of that activity, L1, L2, and so on. A manager's output is thus the sum of the result of individual activities having varying degrees of leverage. Clearly, the key to high output means being sensitive to the leverage of what you do during the day. Managerial productivity, that is, the output of a manager per unit of time worked, can be increased in three ways. 1. Increasing the rate with which a manager performs his activities, speeding up his work. 2. Increasing the leverage associated with the various managerial activities. 3. Shifting the mix of a manager's activities from those with lower to those with higher leverage. Let us consider first the leverage of various types of managerial work. High leverage activities. These can be achieved in three basic ways. When many people are affected by one manager, when a person's activity or behavior over a long period of time is affected by a manager's brief, well-focused set of words or actions, when a large group's work is affected by an individual supplying a unique, key piece of knowledge or information. The first is the most obvious example. Consider Robin, an Intel finance manager, responsible for setting up the annual financial planning process for the company. When Robin defines in advance exactly what information needs to be gathered and presented at each stage of the planning process and lays out who is responsible for what, she directly affects the subsequent work of perhaps 200 people who participate in the planning process. By spending a certain amount of time in advance of the planning activities, Robin will help to eliminate confusion and ambiguity for a large population of managers over an extended period of time. Consequently, her work contributes to the productivity of the entire organization and clearly has great leverage, leverage that depends, however, on when it is performed. Work done in advance of the planning meeting obviously has great leverage. If Robin has to scramble later to help a manager define guidelines and milestones, her work will clearly have much less leverage. Another example of leverage that depends on timely action is what you do when you learn that a valued subordinate has decided to quit. In such a case, you must direct yourself to the situation immediately if you want to change the person's mind. If you put it off, all your chances are lost. Thus, to maximize the leverage of his activities, a manager must keep timeliness, which is often critical, firmly in mind. Leverage can also be negative. Some managerial activities can reduce the output of an organization. I mean something very simple. Suppose I am a key participant at a meeting and I arrive unprepared. Not only do I waste the time of the people attending the meeting because of my lack of preparation, a direct cost of my carelessness, but I deprive the other participants of the opportunity to use that time to do something else. Each time a manager imparts his knowledge, skills, or values to a group, his leverage is high, as members of the group will carry what they learn to many others. But again, leverage can be positive or negative. An example of leverage that I hope is high and positive is my talk in the orientation course. During the 2 hours I have, I try to impart a great deal of information about Intel, its history, its objectives, its values, its style, to a group of 200 new employees. Besides what I say specifically, my approach toward answering questions and my conduct in general communicate our way of doing things to these employees when they are most impressionable. Here is another example of this kind of leverage. To train a group of salesmen, Barbara, an Intel marketing engineer, sets out to teach them what the organization's products are. If she does her job well, the salespeople will be better equipped to sell the line. If she does it poorly, great and obvious damage is done. A final, less formal example here. Cindy, as you recall, is a member of a technical coordinating body in which she tries to disseminate her understanding of a specific technology to all of the company's manufacturing groups. In effect, she uses the coordinating body as an informal training vehicle to affect high leverage on her counterparts in neighboring Intel organizations. A manager can also exert high leverage by engaging in an activity that takes him only a short time, but that affects another person's performance over a long time. A performance review represents a good example of this. With the few hours' work that a manager spends preparing and delivering the review, he can affect the work of its recipient enormously. Here, too, a manager can exert either positive or negative leverage. A subordinate can be motivated and even redirected in his efforts, or the review can discourage and demoralize him for who knows how long. Another seemingly trivial piece of work, creating a tickler file, can improve daily work significantly for a long time. Setting up the simple mechanical aid is a one-time activity, yet it is likely to improve the productivity of the manager who uses it indefinitely. Thus, the leverage here is very, very high. Examples of high negative leverage abound. After going through the annual planning process, an Intel manager saw that, in spite of successful cost reduction efforts in the prior year, his division was still not going to make any money in the coming year. The manager became depressed. Though he didn't realize it, he almost immediately began to affect people around him, and soon depression spread throughout his organization. He snapped out of it only when someone on his staff finally told him what he was doing to the people under him. Another example is waffling, when a manager puts off a decision that will affect the work of other people. In effect, the lack of a decision is the same as a negative decision. No green light is a red light, and work can stop for a whole organization. Both the depressed and the waffling manager can have virtually unlimited negative leverage. If people are badly affected by a poor sales training effort, the situation can be handled by retraining the group. But the negative leverage produced by depression and waffling is very hard to counter because their impact on an organization is both so pervasive and so elusive. Managerial meddling is also an example of negative leverage. This occurs when a supervisor uses his superior knowledge and experience of a subordinate's responsibilities to assume command of a situation rather than letting the subordinate work things through himself. For example, if a senior manager sees an indicator showing an undesirable trend and dictates to the person responsible a detailed set of actions to be taken, that is managerial meddling. In general, meddling stems from a supervisor exploiting too much superior work knowledge, real or imagined. The negative leverage produced comes from the fact that after being exposed to many such instances, the subordinate will begin to take a much more restricted view of what is expected of him, showing less initiative in solving his own problems and referring them instead to his supervisor. Because the output of the organization will consequently be reduced in the long run, meddling is clearly an activity having negative managerial leverage. The third kind of managerial activity with high leverage is exercised by a person with unique skills and knowledge. One such person is an Intel marketing engineer, responsible for setting prices for the product line. Hundreds of salespeople in the field can be negatively affected if prices are set too high. No matter how hard they may try, they won't be able to get any business. Of course, if the prices were set too low, we would be giving money away. Take another example. An Intel development engineer who has uniquely detailed knowledge of a particular manufacturing process effectively controls how it is used. Since the process will eventually provide the foundation for the work of many product designers all over the company, the leverage the development engineer exerts is enormous. The same is true for a geologist in an oil company, or an actuary in an insurance firm. All are specialists whose work is important for the work of their organization at large. the person who comprehends the critical facts, or has the critical insights, the knowledge specialist, or the know-how manager, has tremendous authority and influence on the work of others, and therefore very high leverage. The art of management lies in the capacity to select from the many activities of seemingly comparable significance the one or two or three that provide leverage well beyond the others and concentrate on them. For me, paying close attention to customer complaints constitutes a high-leverage activity. Aside from making a customer happy, the pursuit tends to produce important insights into the workings of my own operation. Such complaints may be numerous, and though all of them need to be followed up by someone, they don't all require or wouldn't all benefit from my personal attention. Which one out of 10 or 20 complaints to dig into, analyze, and follow up is where art comes into the work of a manager. The basis of that art is an intuition that behind this complaint, and not the other, lurk many deeper problems. Delegation as leverage. Because managerial time has a hierarchy of values, delegation is an essential aspect of management. The delegator and delegatee must share a common information base and a common set of operational ideas or notions on how to go about solving problems, a requirement that is frequently not met. Unless both parties share the relevant common base, the delegatee can become an effective proxy only with specific instructions. As in meddling, where specific activities are prescribed in detail, this produces low managerial leverage. Picture this. I am your supervisor, and I walk over to you with pencil in hand and tell you to take it. You reach for the pencil, but I won't let go. So I say, "What is wrong with you? Why can't I delegate the pencil to you?" We all have some things that we don't really want to delegate simply because we like doing them and would rather not let go. For your managerial effectiveness, this is not too bad, so long as it is based on a conscious decision that you will hold on to certain tasks that you enjoy performing, even though you could, if you chose, delegate them. But be sure to know exactly what you're doing and avoid the charade of insincere delegation, which can produce immense negative managerial leverage. Given a choice, should you delegate activities that are familiar to you or those that aren't? Before answering, consider the following principle. Delegation without follow-through is abdication. You can never wash your hands of a task. Even after you delegate it, you are still responsible for its accomplishment. And monitoring the delegated task is the only practical way for you to ensure a result. Monitoring is not meddling, but means checking to make sure an activity is proceeding in line with expectations. Because it is easier to monitor something with which you are familiar, if you have a choice, you should delegate those activities you know best. But recall the pencil experiment and understand before the fact that this will very likely go against your emotional grain. Recall the table of my day's activities. During the executive staff meeting, we heard two follow-up presentations, one on the status of an extremely important marketing program, and the other on the progress of a program aimed at reducing manufacturing throughput times. Both reviews are examples of monitoring. Earlier, we had assigned each to a middle manager and made sure these managers and the senior staff agreed about what the programs were to be. The middle managers then went about their business, expecting to report back to the executive staff, the body that delegated the programs to them. Monitoring the results of delegation resembles the monitoring used in quality assurance. We should apply quality assurance principles and monitor at the lowest added value stage of the process. For example, review rough drafts of reports that you have delegated. Don't wait until your subordinates have spent time polishing them into final form before you find out that you have a basic problem with the contents. A second principle applies to the frequency with which you check your subordinates' work. A variable approach should be employed, using different sampling schemes with various subordinates. You should increase or decrease your frequency depending on whether your subordinate is performing a newly delegated task or one that he has experience handling. How often you monitor should not be based on what you believe your subordinate can do in general, but on his experience with a specific task and his prior performance with it, his task-relevant maturity, something I'll talk about in detail later. As the subordinate's work improves over time, you should respond with a corresponding reduction in the intensity of the monitoring. To use quality assurance principles effectively, the manager should only go into details randomly, just enough to try to ensure that the subordinate is moving ahead satisfactorily. To check into all the details of a delegated task would be like quality assurance testing 100% of what manufacturing turned out. Making certain types of decisions is something managers frequently delegate to subordinates. How is this best done? By monitoring their decision-making process. How do you do that? Let's examine what Intel goes through to approve a capital equipment purchase. We ask a subordinate to think through the entire matter carefully before presenting a request for approval. And to monitor how good his thinking is, we ask him quite specific questions about his request during a review meeting. If he answers them convincingly, we'll approve what he wants. This technique allows us to find out how good the thinking is without having to go through it ourselves. Increasing managerial activity rate, speeding up the line. Of course, the most obvious way to increase managerial output is to increase the rate or speed of performing work. The relationship here is managerial output over time equals L times activity performed over time, where L is the leverage of the activity. The most common approach to increasing a manager's productivity, his output over time, has been time management techniques, which try to reduce the denominator on both sides of this equation. Any number of consultants will tell the manager that the way to higher productivity is to handle a piece of paper only once, to hold only stand-up meetings, which will presumably be short, and to turn his desk so that he presents his back to the door. These time management suggestions can be improved upon, I think, by applying our production principles. First, we must identify our limiting step. What is the egg in our work? In a manager's life, some things really have to happen on a schedule that is absolute. For me, an example is the class I teach. I know when it is going to meet, and I know I must prepare for it. There is no give in the time here, because over 200 students will be expecting me. Accordingly, I have to create offsets and schedule my other work around this limiting step. In short, if we determine what is immovable and manipulate the more yielding activities around it, we can work more efficiently. A second production principle we can apply to managerial work is batching similar tasks. Any manufacturing operation requires a certain amount of setup time. So for managerial work to proceed efficiently, we should use the same setup effort to apply across a group of similar activities. Think about our continuous egg boiler, which was installed to produce fine quality, identical 3-minute eggs. Should we now decide to serve our customers 4-minute eggs, we would have to slow down the conveyor belt moving them through the hot water. The adjustment takes time. Not only do we adjust nuts and bolts on the machine, we also have to inspect the quality of the 4-minute eggs by sampling a few of them. Setup time has many parallels in managerial work. For example, once we have prepared a set of illustrations for a training class, we will obviously increase our productivity if we can use the same set over and over again with other classes or groups. Similarly, if a manager has a number of reports to read or a number of performance reviews to approve, he should set aside a block of time and do a batch of them together, one after the other, to maximize the use of the mental setup time needed for the task. What makes running a factory different from running a job shop? The latter is prepared to service any customer who drops in. The owner handles the job required and moves on to the next one. A factory, on the other hand, is usually run by forecast and not by individual order. From my experience, a large portion of managerial work can be forecasted. Accordingly, forecasting those things you can and setting yourself up to do them is only common sense and an important way to minimize the feeling and the reality of fragmentation experienced in managerial work. Forecasting and planning your time around key events are literally like running an efficient factory. What is the medium of a manager's forecast? It is something very simple: his calendar. Most people use their calendars as a repository of orders that come in. Someone throws an order to a manager for his time, and it automatically shows up on his calendar. This is mindless passivity. To gain better control of his time, the manager should use his calendar as a production planning tool, taking a firm initiative to schedule work that is not time critical between those limiting steps in the day. Another production principle can be applied here. Because manufacturing people trust their indicators, they won't allow material to begin its journey through the factory if they think it is already operating at capacity. If they did, material might go halfway through and back up behind a bottleneck. Instead, factory managers say no at the outset and keep the start level from overloading the system. Other kinds of managers find this hard to apply because their indicators of capacity are not as well established or not as believable. How much time do you need to read your mail, to write your reports, to meet with a colleague? You may not know precisely, but you surely have a feel for the time required. And you should exploit that sense to schedule your work. To use your calendar as a production planning tool, you must accept responsibility for two things. One, you should move toward the active use of your calendar, taking the initiative to fill the holes between the time-critical events with non-time-critical, though necessary, activities. Two, you should say no at the outset to work beyond your capacity to handle. It is important to say no earlier rather than later, because we've learned that to wait until something reaches a higher value stage and then abort due to lack of capacity means losing more money and time. You can obviously say no either explicitly or implicitly, because by not delivering, you end up saying what amounts to no. Remember, too, that your time is your one finite resource, and when you say yes to one thing, you're inevitably saying no to another. The next production principle you can apply is to allow slack, a bit of looseness in your scheduling. Highway planners, for example, know that a freeway can handle an optimum number of vehicles. Having fewer cars means that the road is not being used at capacity. But at that optimum point, if just a few more cars are allowed to enter the traffic flow, everything comes to a crunching halt. With the new metering devices that control access during the rush hour, planners can get a fix on the right number. The same thing can be done for managerial work. There is an optimum degree of loading, with enough slack built in so that one unanticipated phone call will not ruin your schedule for the rest of the day. You need some slack. Another production principle is very nearly the opposite. A manager should carry a raw material inventory in terms of projects. This is not to be confused with his work-in-process inventory, because that, like eggs in a continuous boiler, tends to spoil or become obsolete over time. Instead, this inventory should consist of things you need to do but don't need to finish right away. Discretionary projects, the kind the manager can work on to increase his group's productivity over the long term. Without such an inventory of projects, a manager will most probably use his free time meddling in his subordinates' work. A final principle. Most production practices follow well-established procedures, and, rather than reinventing the wheel repeatedly, use a specific method that has been shown to work before. But managers tend to be inconsistent and bring a welter of approaches to the same task. We should work to change that. As we become more consistent, we should also remember that the value of an administrative procedure is contained not in formal statements, but in the real thinking that led to its establishment. This means that even as we try to standardize what we do, we should continue to think critically about what we do and the approaches we use. Built-in leverage. How many subordinates should you have? An important component of managerial leverage is the number of subordinates a manager has. If he does not have enough, his leverage is obviously reduced. If he has too many, he gets bogged down, with the same result. As a rule of thumb, a manager whose work is largely supervisory should have 6 to 8 subordinates. 3 or 4 are too few, and 10 are too many. This range comes from a guideline that a manager should allocate about a half day per week to each of his subordinates. 2 days a week per subordinate would probably lead to meddling. An hour a week does not provide enough opportunity for monitoring. The 6 to 8 rule is right for the classically hierarchical manager whose primary work is the supervision of others. What about a know-how manager, the middle manager who mainly supplies expertise and information? Even if he works without a single subordinate, servicing a number of varied customers as an internal consultant can in itself be a full-time job. In fact, anyone who spends about a half day per week as a member of a planning, advisory, or coordinating group has the equivalent of a subordinate. So, as a rule of thumb, if a manager is both a hierarchical supervisor and a supplier of know-how, he should try to have a total of 6 to 8 subordinates or their equivalent. Sometimes a business is organized in a way that makes the ideal fan out of 6 to 8 subordinates hard to reach. A manufacturing plant, for example, may have an engineering section and a production section, in which case the plant manager would only have 2 people reporting directly to him. The manager might then choose to act as one of the 2 subordinates, choosing to be his own engineering manager, for instance. If he does that, the manufacturing manager will still report to him, and he will have added the people who would ordinarily report to the head of engineering. So the plant manager will actually have 6 direct reports, 5 engineers, and the manufacturing manager. The arrangement does not have the engineers appearing to be at the same organizational level as the manufacturing manager, something he would surely take exception to. Interruptions. The plague of managerial work. The next important production concept we can apply to managerial work is to strive toward regularity. We could obviously run our breakfast factory more efficiently if customers arrived in a steady and predictable stream rather than dropping in by ones and twos. Though we can't control our customers' habits, we should try to smooth out our workload as much as possible. As noted, we should try to make our managerial work take on the characteristics of a factory, not a job shop. Accordingly, we should do everything we can to prevent little stops and starts in our day, as well as interruptions brought on by big emergencies. Even though some of the latter are unavoidable, we should always be looking for sources of future high-priority trouble by cutting windows into the black box of our organization. Recognizing you've got a time bomb on your hands means you can address a problem when you want to, not after the bomb has gone off. But because you must coordinate your work with that of other managers, you can only move toward regularity if others do too. In other words, the same blocks of time must be used for like activities. For example, at Intel, Monday mornings have been set aside throughout the corporation as the time when planning groups meet. So anybody who belongs to one can count on Monday for that purpose and be free of scheduling conflicts. About 20 middle managers at Intel were once asked to be part of an experiment. After pairing up, they tried some role-playing in which one manager was to define the problem most limiting his output, and the other was to be a consultant who would analyze the problem and propose solutions. The most common problem cited was uncontrolled interruptions, which in remarkably uniform fashion affected both supervisory and know-how managers. Everyone felt that the interruptions got in the way of his own work. Interruptions had a common source, most frequently coming from subordinates and from people outside the manager's immediate organization, but whose work the managers influenced. For those in manufacturing, the interruptions most often came from production operators, and for marketing people, from outside customers. In short, from the consumers of the middle manager's authority and information. The most frequently proposed solutions were not very practical. The idea mentioned most often was to create blocks of time for individual work by hiding physically. But this is a less than happy answer, because the interrupters obviously have legitimate problems. And if the manager responded by hiding, these would pile up. One solution was a suggestion that customers not call marketing managers at certain hours. No good. There are better ways. Let's apply a production concept. Manufacturers turn out standard products. By analogy, if you can pin down what kind of interruptions you're getting, you can prepare standard responses for those that pop up most often. Customers don't come up with totally new questions and problems day in and day out, and because the same ones tend to surface repeatedly, a manager can reduce time spent handling interruptions using standard responses. Having them available also means that a manager can delegate much of the job to less experienced personnel. Also, if you use the production principle of batching, that is, handling a group of similar chores at one time, many interruptions that come from your subordinates can be accumulated and handled not randomly, but at staff and at one-on-one meetings, the subject of the next chapter. If such meetings are held regularly, people can't protest too much if they're asked to batch questions and problems for scheduled times instead of interrupting you whenever they want. The use of indicators, especially the bank of indicators kept over time, can also reduce the time a manager spends dealing with interruptions. How fast he can answer a question depends on how fast he can put his finger on the information he needs for a response. By maintaining an archive of information, a manager doesn't have to do ad hoc research every time the phone rings. If the people who interrupt you knew how much they were disturbing you, they would probably police themselves more closely and cut down on the number of times they felt they had to talk to you right away. In any case, a manager should try to force his frequent interrupters to make an active decision about whether an issue can wait. So, instead of going into hiding, a manager can hang a sign on his door that says, "I am doing individual work. Please don't interrupt me unless it really can't wait until 2 o'clock. Then, hold an open office hour and be completely receptive to anybody who wants to see you. The key is this. Understand that interrupters have legitimate problems that need to be handled. That's why they're bringing them to you. But you can channel the time needed to deal with them into organized, scheduled form by providing an alternative to interruption, a scheduled meeting, or an office hour. The point is to impose a pattern on the way a manager copes with problems. To make something regular that was once irregular is a fundamental production principle. And that's how you should try to handle the interruptions that plague you.